Chocolate. Chocolate is universally loved, I think, a universal panacea, that little square of it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon gets you through that afternoon slump. It's the multi-purposed gift for that someone special.
I know I should have. Yes, but... Look, I'm trying to tell you. If only you'd let me get a word in edgeways. All right, I'll be around right away.
Phew. Just as well I've got these.
He likes milk tray. She likes milk tray.
Sing to Rennie, it's a milk tray day today.
Yes, chocolate. A product also loaded with gendered and often sexist assumption. Emma Robertson is a La Trobe University historian. She's author of Chocolate, Women and Empire, A Social and Cultural History. And she joins me now. We're gonna unwrap this little block of sweetness, the history of this food. And Emma, you have a personal connection to this whole chocolate story.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm from the city of York in the UK, and mm-hmm. chocolate was really very much present in my life from a child. So there are two major factories in York. There was the Rountree factory, which was the Kit Kat, origin of Kit Kat, and also Terry's, which is chocolate orange, of course, Christmas loved everywhere. But and I grew up in that city, and it was a major employer. So a lot of my family worked there, and that's what inspired me to start looking at it, especially some of the women in my family, my grandma, my aunties. My mom had a brief stint at the Rountree factory, and just surrounded by chocolate factories, the smell of chocolate, and also the sort of charitable things that some of the factory owners had done. So my school was called Joseph Rountree School. There was Joseph Rountree Park.
Good
where
Lord.
I fetched the ducks. I learnt to swim in the Joseph Rountree swimming pool. So yeah, very much sort of surrounded by it in York.
Women make chocolate.
Yes. Yes, women were very important in the factory. And that's where I started, was looking at the factory side of things. So more than half of the women working at Rountree's were... Often more than half of the workforce were women who were working at Rountree's, and they were doing a lot of the jobs around packing chocolates, decorating chocolates, sorting things, sorting nuts, all these kind of really important parts of the chocolate making process.
Mm. Where in the history of chocolate, let's actually begin a little with that. I mean, where this came from and how we started manufacturing it in such quantity.
Yeah, I mean, I did go... and tried to look a little bit at the long history of chocolate. I'm not an archaeologist, and there's lots of really interesting archaeological work that's been done. And I think it was just last year they pushed the date of chocolate, sort of consumption of chocolate, back another 1,500 years to about 5,000 years ago. So
wow.
Looking at it sort of South and Central American origins. I sort of pick up the story when the empires get involved, the mm-hmm. European empires, looking at first the Spanish who land in the Americas and discover, in inverted commas, chocolate and sort of find this commodity and take it back to Europe. And then especially I'm looking at from 17th and 18th centuries, which is when it starts to become a really sort of elite luxury product to consume by people who are quite wealthy. And it's really in the 19th century that it becomes a mass-produced, much more affordable object that is made in factories. So people like Rountree's and Cadbury's from the later 19th century.
When does it become feminized in terms of its marketing?
Yeah, I mean, I think... In terms of the broader history, quite early on, it sort of gets these connections with femininity and sexuality in the domestic sphere. So you have these stories about Spanish queens who are infatuated with the product.
Mm.
And so there seems to be this quite a long history of connecting chocolate to women. But in terms of the marketing, it's quite early on. But what fascinates me in terms of the industrial manufacturers is that they have lots of different chocolate products. And so they market them in slightly different ways. So the cocoa drink... That's very much around household consumption and women as housewives making a healthy drink for their family. And then the chocolate assortments, that's very much sort of gift, a heterosexual courtship gift. And then you have things like the kids' chocolates, Smarties for Rountree's, and that's marketed very much at kids. So it has all these different things. And you do have those chocolates like Yorkie from the Rountree case that is manufactured and marketed at men. But yeah, for a long
time.
But
that's rare, isn't it?
I mean, it's quite rare. Yeah, it is mainly women.
The man's chocolate is a bit anomalous.
And there's a lovely piece quite early. Be maybe early 20th century where they're thinking about marketing and they say, you know, men like things that they can put in their pockets and they like sweets, fruit pastels and things that they can kind of have in their pockets. And it's not, I don't know, maybe chocolate's too messy.
What are the assumptions then about femininity that dispose women to the consumption of chocolate?
I think there's an association with indulgence, with sexuality. Sexuality is often sort of put onto women as something that's kind of, women are sexual and indulgent. I think sometimes just the practicalities of early chocolate make it sort of quite associated with the domestic sphere. It's quite complicated to make before it gets into the industrial manufacture. And I wonder, I don't know, but I wonder if that's part of it, that it's kind of this complicated thing that is made in the domestic sphere. It's much richer than something like coffee, and it doesn't have that same association with being as it is a stimulant, but not to the same degree that coffee is. It seems to be coffee that becomes very much a male product in the 18th century, and tea and chocolate start to move into this female sphere. So there's a lot of complicated things going on over the centuries, really, and Hampson's or how it gets feminized.
When did it become that sort of, as you mentioned there, a rite of heterosexual transaction? This is a, you know, a gift of apology or a gift to please the woman in one's life.
I mean, in the period that I'm looking at in terms of the industrial manufacture of chocolate, it seems to be those assortments and the chocolate assortments and that the sort of ones with the centres, chocolate centres, and that the production of a chocolate box that becomes something of a more luxury item, and therefore it's more like to be a gift, something you might pay a little bit more for rather than a chocolate bar that might be something you eat on the go. And it seems to be with the chocolate boxes that's the real... They see that as very much something that is heterosexual courtship, and that's where. So that would be mid-19th and 20th century thing. And marketing really, I think, takes off from the late 19th century and different kinds of colour in posters, and then TV and radio much later. Marketing as a whole area becomes much more important for those 20th century manufacturers.
So there's some gendered assumptions around manufacture and marketing and so forth. But in the colonial transaction of the production of the cocoa itself, women are very much involved in that at the source of the product.
Yeah, and that's where my research started to take me as I went into my more postgraduate research. So I looked at chocolate making in York in the factory, and then I started to think about where is this cocoa coming from and how is it being connected to histories of the British Empire particularly. And that's what took me back to West Africa in the 20th century, from the mid-20th century. Well, from the interwar period, they start to look at West Africa. British colonies, that cocoa can be grown there, and they feel they can obtain it pretty cheaply. And then when I started to look at that, I was interested in, you know, what role have women had as farmers. I know that they're in the factories, I know that they're really important, but what has been their role as cocoa producers? And I found them very much involved in what, you know, really cocoa didn't grow that well as a plantation crop, certainly early on, and they figured out, oh, this is actually better as small-scale farms, so family farms, right. And women are very important in all the tasks on that, both sort of the early stages of setting up cocoa trees, but then the harvesting of cocoa, the separating of the beans from the pods. Women are very involved in that, the transporting of cocoa as well. So, yeah, I found women involved.
It's not just a sort of a gender discussion. There's a race discussion in this as well, and it's displayed in microcosm in that sort of perfect world of chocolate Willy Wonka you deal with as well in your book, that this is... In a way, the entire sort of colonial transaction and gendered transaction around chocolate sort of set down in one little story.
Yeah, and it was great to go back to Roald Dahl's book, which I'd grown up with, and to look at the earliest version, which very explicitly talks about, you know, deepest, darkest Africa, in the text. But by the 80s, when I was reading it, that had all been sort of exercised out, and it was all, they were orange Oompa Loompas, and they sort of came from Oompa Loompa land.
The various colour changes of Oompa Loompas over time.
Various changes of colour. Yeah, and in both the book and then in the film version as well. So, yeah, I was interested in how race has been part of, the chocolate industry, chocolate marketing, the popular culture around chocolate, and how ideas about race have circulated.
It's such an interesting trend, I guess, in understanding the past, in history, of looking at commodities and the way in which they demonstrate the broader story of cultures.
Yeah, there have been some great commodity histories recently. James Walvin, one on sugar, is one that I really admire. And I think they just give us that way of connecting up so many different things. If you look at that commodity chain and you look at, you know, where it's coming, where the commodity's being farmed, who's doing that, then how does it get moved around the world, who's doing that, who's doing the sort of maybe the manufacturing side, how has it been marketed? And it's just this really nice way of connecting up different places and different times. And so, yeah, those commodity histories have become very marketable, but I think it's always that there's a romance about them too. There's a sort of allure of the commodity that it's hard sometimes to get back into the nitty-gritty of the economics of it.
But it gives us all a toehold into the story. There's a recognisable component there. But in your exploration of this in chocolate, I mean, what surprised you? What jumped out as you dug into that story?
In some ways, the sort of depth of the stories, the way in which stories about chocolate have been circulating and recirculating, and these myths around this product, and just how sort of embedded it is in Western culture, and how just how powerful it is as a symbol. Mm. I think that struck me more and more as I started to look at, you know, even things like Fiction Chocolat and Like Water for Chocolate, Willy Wonka, and the ways in which it's just circulating in all these different ways. And it's such a sort of malleable commodity. It can be shaped into chocolate Easter bunnies, or it can be, you know, a beautiful gift, or it can be this very high-end product, or something that's very cheap and at the checkout you just pick it up, and just such a varied product. I think I was sort of surprised by that. I knew a little bit about chocolate, but yeah, when you start to delve into it and just how embedded it is in culture, it's interesting.
And once you start to think about it, and you rattle through a few examples there from Easter eggs to the checkout, it is so ubiquitous.
Yeah, it's just everywhere, and people are fascinated by it. And there's always reports coming out, whether it's good for you or bad for you and what it can do for you. You know, we love to talk about that. And we, you know, it's one of those products that just, it does get people interested and excited. So that's been lots of fun to work with that as a historian.
Is this a fundamentally Western phenomenon?
I think, I haven't done much on this. I mean, I'm interested in how chocolate works in different places, and Japan's one place that I've been quite interested in how chocolate works there, and how important it is there as a part of a gift relationship. And Kit Kat particularly, the York factory experimented with different types of Kit Kat, but and never really took off. I remember my auntie who worked there telling me, oh, it didn't really work, and we had to keep changing the machines. But in Japan,
the green tea Kit Kat is a bit
it's
weird.
It's just everywhere, and all these different types, and different. Yep. You know, they have it in different regions, and you buy chocolate as a, you know, a Kit Kat as a souvenir from a particular place, and just that the giving ritual is there. I think it's White Day, where it's traditional for the women to give men chocolate, so it's not necessarily logical or common sense that it's always this heterosexual gift from a man to a woman, that, you know, it can really vary in different cultures. So I'm interested in how it's been picked up in Japan.
Are you still a fan? Has this put you off?
Definitely still a fan. I think I've said to a few people that being in the archives and looking at lots of different chocolate adverts over the years makes you very, very hungry. It's telling you how much you should eat some chocolate, and you really should eat some chocolate, and you should listen to your stomach telling you it's time to eat some chocolate. Oh, so you're just wading through. And I have been lucky enough to, you know, to go into one of the Rauchi curators. I was able to go there, and, you know, and Cadbury's, when I go there to the archives, they give me chocolate. And yeah,
of course.
I don't turn my nose up at that at all. I'm very happy to indulge still. Well, and I just had a chocolate brownie on my way here. So, you know.
Emma Robertson's life in chocolate. You, dear listener, I'm imagining may well be, your mind may have in the process of these last few minutes turned to chocolate
it
as
It has
well.
Already. I'm just, yeah, and it is, yeah, sort of the chocolate historian. It's not such a bad thing to be. There are a lot of worse things.
Emma, thank you so very much. Emma Robertson is that chocolate historian from La Trobe University, and she's the author of Chocolate, Women and Empire, A Social and Cultural History. And this is Blueprint. Yes, go on, have some chocolate. It's okay. Blueprint here on RN.